morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. It's Monday the 9th. We expect some of our colleagues will be arriving a little bit late. The weather has made it a little more difficult for some than others. We don't have any introduction of committee measures today, so we're going to proceed directly to our informational hearing on innovation, turning our attention from higher education to the second of our three pillars. I'm glad that it kind of fits in between, because I think what we'll see today is the connections between higher education and workforce development provided by innovation. Vince, if you'd like to kick us off, Vince Porter from the Governor's Office, and then we have three panels representing Oregon Inc., Growth Board, and some related infrastructure. Vince, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Vince Porter. I'm the governor's policy advisor on economy and jobs. I'll be very brief, but I just first wanted to thank you for taking the time to have a hearing that encompasses three different elements that was in the governor's budget that we really wanted to focus on tied to innovation. And the reason why I think it's a great opportunity today is that maybe in the past we've looked at these three separate buckets of funding as separate, but you'll find out today and hopefully in the future that they actually are working very well together, both Oregon Inc., the Oregon Growth Board, and RAIN, which started off as a regional solutions project, are really leveraging each other's resources and getting the maximum value out of each. So just with that, I again appreciate the chair for taking the time to bring them all together and see how they're interconnected and also explore how we can do even better.
Thanks. Any questions for Vince? Thanks for the introduction. So our first panel on Oregon Inc., led off by the Chair John Morgan, and we also have Ryan Jensen, Steve Westberg, and Sean McLean. We've got four chairs here, so you guys can join us. We appreciate it.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
How are you? All right. Well, good morning. I am John Morgan. I am the chair of the Oregon Innovation Council. That is my non-day job. My day job is I am chief executive officer of Avamere Health Services based in Wilsonville, Oregon. And I've been involved with Oregon Inc. for the last 9 years, the last three as chair. I'd like to run you through just a quick overview, a few slides this morning, and hopefully that'll lead to some questions you might have. Just a little bit of history on Oregon, the Oregon Innovation Council. This was really an investment that the state made a few years ago to really do two things. One, to drive job growth and wage growth in the state of Oregon, and really allow the state to focus on innovative business opportunities in which the resources that we have as a state could be deployed in such a way as to, again, drive job growth and wage growth in the state. Launched 10 years ago, one of the things that's unique about the Oregon Innovation Council really is a public-private combination where it brings business leaders, brings state representatives, and it brings those from the university and the academic community together to really focus on these areas. Originally funded in 2007 with an initial funding of $26 million. From that, we've created three signature research centers, which I think you all may be aware of. ONAMI, certainly one of those I'm sure you probably have some familiarity with. Oregon Best, and then OTRATI. Those three were really what I would say is the foundational aspects for this, and over the course of a number of years, we've invested in a number of different individual initiatives, which I'll describe in a moment. And really, this was set up and funded as a discretionary option outside the department's budget. If you really look at the objectives of Oregon Innovation Council, it really is, as I mentioned, was to drive job and wage growth in the state. It was also really intent on looking at what is unique within the state of Oregon and how we leverage those unique aspects, whether they be resource, academic, certainly human capital, in the best way possible, and to try and position us for a competitive advantage. As we started the program, I think the viewpoint was that we had opportunities to expand Oregon's research universities, really from a resource standpoint, bringing this together to really create what has now become a nationally recognized set of programs and initiatives. This was really, I think, the key thing as I joined the council many years ago, was this idea of how do we create competitiveness for our universities? How do we create competitiveness within the areas that we work within Oregon Inc., and how do we maintain that over a long period of time? And probably most importantly, and I'll get to in a second, is setting up the measurements that we utilize to really evaluate our progress was something that, as chair of the account, really of the audit and accountability group when I first joined Oregon Inc., it was really to develop those standards which we would hold ourselves accountable. And then lastly is, you know, one of the things that's most important is if you're not seeing a return on the investment that the state's making in innovation, it's difficult to think about continuing that. And I think we'll talk about what types of returns we've seen. As I mentioned, we set very stringent reporting requirements. We have a quarterly audit process that is completed for each of the initiatives and the signature research centers. That group right now is headed by Dudley Slater, the former chief executive officer of Integra Telecom, and now actually works for Cambia Health Solutions, running their for-profit business arm. He oversees that process and really then applies the measurements that we have asked to see from each of the initiatives and make certain that those are being met over the course of the relationship with each. I think the one thing that I would probably hang our hat on is the results that we've seen over the period of time that Oregon Inc. has been involved have been, I think, in a word, impressive. We have really invested in these initiatives over the course of the last several biennia, about $77 million of state funds. From that, we've seen nearly $600 million in economic return for that investment to the state, either through follow-on funding or other federal or state grants that have come with that. And if you do it on an ROI basis, that's about 7-to-1. And I will tell you that that rivals private equity, venture capital type returns. And we have seen nearly 300 Oregon-based firms utilize the signature research centers for the different shared opportunities. And just in the last biennium, we've seen 258 jobs created. And then through this current biennium, 164. So we're starting to see the ramp up of job creation through the work that we've done.
Could you, before you go on, I'm sorry to interrupt, could you say a little bit more about those jobs?
Sure.
You know, having been part of it, that's a pretty conservative number.
I think the one thing I can tell you is this has been an ongoing debate within the council, and that is how do we actually measure the actual job impact that we have had. And I can tell you we use absolutely the most conservative way of measuring job creation in the state. This is direct, measurable jobs that we have seen come from the investments that we've made. This does not in any way reflect the ancillary nature or what I would call the trickle-down effect of job growth in the state. We have held ourselves to, I think, enormously high and appropriate standards in the measurement of this activity, and I think that we are very proud of the fact that we've really maintained that rigor in the way that we have measured ourselves. But this is, again, you can look at the economics in one way, you can look at job creation a little bit differently, but if you take it in total, I think the impact both on the job creation front as well as just the economic return to the state on both fronts have done exceedingly well. This is just a quick graphic. It shows you A couple of things I wanted to point out. One, just the VAT. Oh, I'm sorry.
Interrupt one more second. Yes, I think so.
Representative, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Morgan, very much. Those jobs, could you put a price range or how much salary are we talking about?
Yeah, well, you know, the goal here is to create above average wages. The actual number, the specific dollar amount, I don't have in front of me, but I will tell you that on every benchmark you look at, these are higher than family wage jobs in all cases. So you're looking at something that is enhancing both the ability for the state to point to something and say we're creating the right types of jobs with this investment. That's clear. The issue is how much of that, if you look at the very conservative way in which we've measured this, the job creation number that you see there are clearly significantly above family wage jobs.
Thank you, sir.
This graphic points out just some of the organizations that have had impact from the investments that we've made in Oregon Inc. The one thing I'd point out, this was something that as I came in following Dave Chen as chair, one of the things that I really wanted to try and add to what we had done before is the broadening of the reach of the Oregon Innovation work and certainly of the initiatives that we fund. When I say that, we didn't want this to be an I-5 corridor program where it was simply going between Corvallis and Eugene and Portland, and that was really where the emphasis was. As you can see on this graphic, the influence here, we have had opportunities to participate across the state of Oregon. In virtually every corner of the state has had some influence from the investments that we've made, and we continue to look at those initiatives. When I first became chair, we did make a concerted effort. We did a roadshow talking about just exactly what Oregon Inc. was about across the state, and from that we've actually funded initiatives that really focus on other areas outside of the Portland metro area. So if you look at the 2015-2017 budget ask, the number is $29.35 million, which is really coming from the use of proposed lottery funding. It funds virtually all of the 2015 innovation plan proposals. And the way this process is done, just so you know, this is a vetting process that we go through to really look at those particular initiatives. They make presentations to a very broad audience. So you have basically 200 business leaders from across the state that are involved in one aspect or another in the evaluation of the different proposals. And we look at those for what's their immediate impact, what's their long-term impact on the state, how are they utilizing the unique state resources that we have, what is their forecast on economics and job growth, and all of those things are factored in, but they're evaluated basically in a process not dissimilar to what a venture capital or private equity firm would go through as they look at investments that they're making. So it's a very rigorous, very detailed, and I think very significant process. And to just give a little bit more clarity, in many of these cases, we'll have groups that will come and present and clearly may not be ready sort of for prime time for investments that we might want to make, but we give them feedback. We actually help teach them how to come back, how to bring together more participants across their areas of influence, how to bring them back and how to reposition. And we've actually seen them come back in a second go around and have a much more successful outcome than they did in the first. So it's a process, not a one time necessarily you're in or you're out. So it's been a positive in that regard. If you look at the initiatives that are on this 29.35 budget ask, you really have the top three, which are Otrati, who is overseen by Jennifer Fox, who's in the audience today. You have Anami with Skip Rung, and then you have Oregon Best with his David Kenny as the executive director. Those are the three signature research centers And as you can see, the funding levels for those are significant in a couple of ways. One, we have shown real traction in the work that has taken place across the entire spectrum of those three signature research centers. The budget ask was vetted very significantly, and we feel that this is appropriate for the development stage of each one of those. You see Drive Oregon, which is, if you're unfamiliar, which is really Oregon's effort to support the electric vehicle industry, Oregon Storyboard, Oregon Wave Energy, which I know you're all familiar with, SOAR, which is, again, the Unmanned Aerial Vehicle Initiative, and then the one that I really had to learn a little bit about was the Internet of Things investment that we made. And for those of you that are unfamiliar with that terminology, but that is the ability to basically connect all of the different technology that we all use on a day-to-day basis and make them work in a more integrated fashion, in a smarter way, and to make all of these things what I like to call work and play well together. This is a very exciting area of work, and one that really is the next phase from an IT development standpoint. So very exciting technology. So that is that's an overview of Oregon Inc., and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the chair? Let's hear from your co-panelists, and I'm betting that they will generate some more conversation as well.
Okay.
Please.
Okay. Thank you for having me. Thank you, Chair Reed. My name is Ryan Jensen. Hopefully I'm not too loud. If I am, let me know. But my name is Ryan Jensen. I'm CEO at Honeycomb Corporation. And at Honeycomb, we're in the business of producing agricultural drones, unmanned aircraft systems. And we are part of the Oregon BEST program as well. So I'll kind of talk about that experience, but also, I guess, kind of dovetail, too, into what you talked about. We fall into the SOAR Oregon, if you will, the Internet of Things, and then the clean tech. So have a mix here. And talk a little bit about kind of our story. My background is actually engineering. Right now, I am doing primarily the business development at Honeycomb, but engineering is kind of my background, spacecraft systems, aerospace, and so forth. And so I grew up on a ranch as well, so I kind of have the background of things that fly and agriculture, and so it kind of worked out well to get in the business of agricultural drones and robotics. So we started out in 2012, that's when we were founded, three co-founders, soon after that, we kind of started building out the prototype. The hardware, thought there was something here, and at that time this wasn't really a thing anywhere. When we said we were going to deploy agricultural drones or agricultural robots, people kind of looked at us funny. But as you, I'm sure you know now, UAS, non-manned aircraft systems, and then their application in agriculture is quite a hot topic. And fortunately, Oregon BEST was there to actually help us get going. And so we received a $75,000 investment from them. At the time, it was three of us working to get this going. And that was last year that we got that. And we were at, like I said, about three, four people. Today, we're closing in on 20 employees. And we've raised about $1 million last year of additional funding. And so this year we're looking to double and get to about 40 employees and a multiple of revenue on the investment that we have. So it's a very hot space. We're in big data, UAS, Internet of Things, all of those things, clean tech as well. And the real big benefit that we saw from, you know, the Oregon BEST program was, you know, multiple components. One was kind of the advice up front. We had this big idea, this grandiose idea of developing a particular type of the technology, and they actually were instrumental in helping us to kind of focus that to where we are now, which is the product that we actually have now, which is actually in dealerships, you know, in different parts of the country. We have sales and so forth. And so that product that they help us kind of craft that vision around is actually on shelves at tractor dealers, like I said, across the country. So that was useful. The funding was also useful, and then the partnership with Oregon State University. So we have a partnership with forestry and Precision Ag, and that's in Pendleton, and then actually in the Oregon State and their kind of their forest program. And so both of those also allowed us to, the credibility of the backing of the university, but also the research component and the advice and the mentorship and the advisorship from the faculty there. So that was also an important component to getting additional funds, right? So one of the hard parts about the startup, especially in a very new industry, is getting that first money in, getting that credibility. It's actually huge. And so that component in itself has been very, very important to us raising, like I said, the additional million on top of that. And to kind of talk a little bit about jobs, I know that's a big important component of all this, and you know, you have to have a return on investment. I'm a business guy. Return on investment is key. It's important. And a portion of that is jobs. And a lot of that money, that million that's come in, has actually come from outside the state. So we have money in the state. The job makeup is manufacturing to software development to mechanical engineering, sales, marketing, all of that. So we kind of bit off a big project. So we have multiple departments across all sorts of technology spaces, but also the requirement of lots of different types of jobs, including manufacturing. We utilize 3D printing for prototyping. We have multiple employees that help the manufacturing process. We try and keep it in the state as well. Everything that we do is out of Wilsonville, Oregon. And so we're also looking to build and, like I said, grow to at least double that size this year, and again, keep it in the state and continue to grow across the country and actually across the world as well with distribution. So that's kind of the quick story. I don't know how long I took, but
that's great.
If you have any questions for me, please feel free to ask. I've been in the kind of the entrepreneurship, innovation, all of that for quite some time, familiar with kind of all the programs in Portland as well, from Portland State Business Accelerator, where we started out, to Oregon Fest, to all sorts of things. So I do have thoughts on that, but also really believe in this initiative. It's very important, and I think that it requires resources that are not just financial, but also people, individuals, and all of that and so forth. So
thank you. Representative Reardon and then Representative McEwen.
Well, thank you very much for your presentation this morning. We're very concerned about where the workforce is coming from in Oregon to feed your growth, and just wondered how many of your employees are Oregon folks, and maybe are you having to go out of state?
All of them are Oregon. Everyone's from Oregon.
Okay, thank you.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Thank you for being here today. I had a presentation in our Ag Committee in the last session, and it was just fascinating to see how your product works in the ag industry. And as an old ag major, it was very impressive. I guess my question is, where would you be had this support system that the state provided not been here?
Wow, that's a tough one. I think we would be further behind. I think it would have, I mean, obviously the timing that it came in was very key, and so it was also at a time where it was very difficult to get any sort of private investment because of regulatory, also market adoption, all of these things. So where would we be? I think we would be, you know, maybe 6 months to a year behind. We would be in a less competitive position. I think our ability to raise additional funding would have been also suspect as well. This is really one of those big growth industries, so the timing was very, very key, and access to a resource that could accelerate that is very, very important. So I know that ours is a particular case. It's a special case where timing, access to resource, access to people, growing that network, it was the right time, right place, right amount, and that's kind of the best way I can. I like to feel like I would find the resources and make it happen some other way, but this definitely was one of them.
Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Williams.
Mr. Chair, you briefly, touched on the PSU Business Accelerator. Can you expand on what your experience was there and how that worked for you?
Yeah, so we had literally gone from my garage to the Portland State Business Accelerator, and my experience there is kind of, again, multiple fold, from the people to the access to resources to the simplicity of, you know, we have a space, let's just get going. And so it was the first actual real office space that we had. And being new and early, you don't want to actually worry about too many other things. You want to focus on developing product and also have mentors and people and access to, you know, other minds. And so that, I would say, was also a very important aspect of being in that environment and simplifying, you know, kind of the overhead of finding space and, you know, leases that are long-term and all of that other stuff that's can be a pain.
Excellent. Thank you.
Representative Gallegos, then Representative Newman.
Yeah, I just had a question. You said your employees are from Oregon. Where are they getting educated?
We have one of our co-founders is from OIT, so we seem to have a ability to attract a lot of those people. So OIT, Portland State, some from Clackamas Community College. So yeah, PSU, OIT, CCC. Let's see. I think that's about kind of the makeup from the schools.
Thank you. Basically, what I was trying to get at is I think that a lot of our assumptions is that we're having to go not just out of state for employees, but out of the state for education. And I think that's a really important thing we want to be able to track. Thank you.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the presentation, Mr. Jensen. Can you give me some examples of some of the tasks that agricultural drones do?
Yeah, so there's – I can talk a lot about that. There's a kind of a few broad tasks. So there's scouting, there's mapping, there's kind of – and that goes into farm management. So the big ones are kind of the idea of what's going on with my crop. And what's going on with my crop on a regular basis? And what can I see? Can I see where there's stress? Can I see where there's irrigation problems? Can I see where there's pest infestation disease? And so, again, the engineer is going to come out a little bit, but with different spectral indices and different cameras, basically, you can see different things. But a really key component of this is now you can actually get that information on a very regular basis. You can actually be proactive instead of reactive. And what's really happening is this combination between robotics, deployment on demand of get this whatever information you want in the camera world or whatever, in the spectral world, you can go get it. Now we can pump that into the cloud. All of our processing is done in the cloud. And now we can actually deploy high compute resources to figure things out, to find best practices, to say, look, you have a problem here or you have a problem here or that this pattern is developing. And so that's just kind of where this precision ag movement is going. And that's kind of at the stage we're at, it's scouting, it's mapping. It's saying, here's what's going on here. We have problem areas. And here's a map to show you. And it's actually very, very useful product in itself, but it's going further. I mean, what's coming next is, proactive types of information is what you should do. So,
thank you.
Thanks. Are we ready? Let's hear from you, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Steve Westberg, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Onboard Dynamics, which is based in Bend, Oregon. Our company is working to commercialize technology to allow vehicles to self-refuel with natural gas. The current system for refueling via natural gas requires incredibly expensive infrastructure to be built out. There was some mention on electric vehicles. Really, that infrastructure is going to take some money to build out. What our company is talking about is basically the ability to drive up to your house, plug into your barbecue hose, and use technology and equipment on your own vehicle to refill its natural gas tank. So really trying to leverage, not recreate new systems, not recreate infrastructure, basically using the infrastructure that's in place. We are a really early stage company, and I'll follow up to the comments that was made about raising funding. When you're out there as a new company, especially developing new technology, that first money in is so vitally important. But even before that, I think Onboard Dynamics has taken advantage of a lot of initiatives through the state, starting with economic development for Central Oregon, plugging together resources to allow technology. The technology we're developing is a spin out from OSU Cascades, which is another funding thing we could talk about somewhere else.
Can I interrupt for just a second? Representative McEwen has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Thank you for being here. I'm not clear on when you say you're going to somebody's residence. Are these for homes that don't have a direct connection for natural gas that are using?
No. This is talking about vehicle refueling.
Transportation refueling.
Yes.
Okay.
So
I heard barbecue, and it confused me a little bit.
I'm sorry about that. So basically what ends up happening is natural gas refueling stations that are out there commercially available now have to pressurize that natural gas to a really high level. We're talking a couple thousand PSI. Mm-hmm. The natural gas that comes out of your hose at your house for your barbecue is about 5 PSI. So we're using the engine and other pieces on the vehicle to help the vehicle refuel itself.
Go ahead, please.
So what I see you saying is you in essence can be a driver towards incentivizing fueling for cars, not necessarily truck fleet fueling, but residential fueling for compressed gas for transportation.
Actually, our first product is for commercial fleets,
okay.
Pickup vehicles.
So you're doing both?
Yeah, we're going to be doing both.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. It's very fascinating.
Yeah. Representative Hayden.
Chair Reed, one follow-up on that. Do you conceive that people would eventually be able to access that grid for their barbecue to fuel their vehicle?
Yes.
That's the intent, right?
Yes, that's the intent. And we're actually jumping ahead a little bit. We're actually working on some technology to try to suck some money out of California, some grant funding out of California to fund our development. So that's for hybrids. But our first product is in the commercial fleet pickup truck space.
I think we're done for the moment.
That's fine. Back to the funding mechanism. So we're spin out of OSU Cascades. We did initially work through the OSU Accelerator Program. And that OSU Accelerator Program then assisted us in preparing our final commercialization plan, which helped us to submit and win $3.6 million award from ARPA-E, which is Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy. Part of that $3.6 million award required us to go out and raise matching funds. So we ended up having to, as a company, go outside of the federal award and raise an additional $720,000. To do that, fortunately, some of our technology is using technologies that are driven out of ONAMI. So we were able to secure some funding through ONAMI's award, and we are actually continuing to do development using some ONAMI technology through OSU on heat exchangers specifically. We are also able to secure a convertible note funding round from Oregon Best, which enabled us, those two together, enabled us to attract additional investment to meet our matching requirement and bring that $3.6 million into the state. Another nice thing to say about that is if we continue to hit on our milestones, which our milestones started last year in October, so we haven't had too long to continue to hit on our milestones, but we have also, there is a follow-on award of another $3 million that comes in 18 months. Which will then once again require an additional round of matching funds. But by that point in time, the technology will be far enough down the pipeline, thanks to ONAMI and Oregon Best and the resources, other resources of the state, to enable us to attract that additional investment, enabling us to move from a really early stage technology development, which from an investor standpoint is incredibly risky, to not being the first money in, to having the technology fleshed out and developed and being investable. So really without, you know, the assistance of, you know, Oregon State, I feel like Grammy Awards here, I'll thank everybody. But, you know, without the help from the state of Oregon, ONAMI, Oregon Best, OSU, OSU Cascades continues to do, we fund development work through them at this point in time as well. But without them, really, the technology would not be moving forward.
That's great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions?
Yes, sir.
Representative Wisnik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Westberg. We're proud. We're amazed at this, and this is what we need. I agree with Mr. Morgan. We need job growth and wage growth. I worked in the Research and Development Department of Defense, and I understand the term early investment is important. Why did you go to, you went to several different people seeking money? That takes a lot of time and expertise, different kind of expertise in engineering or manufacturing. Can you, why? And is Mr. Morgan, are you looking at return on investment? I mean, we keep going grants and grants and grants. At some time, you know, the return on investment never comes in.
I'll take the second part first.
Yes, sir.
We constantly look at return. We look at return in across a number of different factors. But clearly, the money that's being deployed from the state through Oregon Inc., as you can hear, is filtering its way into a number of different funding mechanisms now, either through the signature research centers themselves have a way to now fund some of these types of initiatives directly. The beauty of this, it's really aligning the appropriate groups with the appropriate organizations around need and around what is really resonates within the state of Oregon. What are our critical, what I call, you know, it's really what's our capacity, one first, and what is our competency in these areas. I think the businesses and the universities and the signature research centers, they all come together at sort of a touch point where those things make the most sense. So we look at all of those, and the signature research centers themselves have a similar vetting process as well as return scenario that they look at for the investments that they're making. So across the board, I think we are very, very rigorous in ensuring that there is a return. The other thing we look at is just company development. How many companies are spinning out of the research that's being done? So that's another metric that we look at. But I think the biggest thing that you hear from both of these gentlemen is the fact that it is very, very important at early stage companies to have the ability to show investors that you have a relationship and early money in your business that is in some ways validating the technology and what you're doing, and then that helps sort of get the ball rolling for recurring investment. So those are all things that we look at.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I appreciate that, and I'm not an expert in all this, but we have a record of not some success with Betsy, and over, you know, we went beyond research and development with the funding for Betsy.
Well, again, I think I would tell you as a business person and someone who's been involved in technology development across much of my career in the medical technology and device sector that we employ very, very rigorous audit and accountability requirements for all of these. I would hazard a guess that you will find nothing that's invested in the state that has the same rigor and the same really responsibility it feels back to not only to the state but to all of the other groups that, you know, we have received funding for certain reasons. One, we've been able to do that because we've been able to show returns over time. And it's also in an area that helps drive our state in a much, what I can say, a very important direction. And without that maintaining that rigor, I think you're exactly right. We could run into the problem where we're just another group of initiatives. That's not the case.
Thank you, sir, for this comment.
Thank you. One more person on our panel as it relates to Oregon Inc. Is Sean McLean here? Oh, very good. So maybe I could ask one of you to give up your seat. Thanks. Thanks, John.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to be here. And I'd like to also thank Dr. Jennifer Fox from Otrati for allowing me to speak on Otrati's behalf and what Otrati has done to really stimulate our company and what we've done. My name is Sean McLean. I am the co-founder and CEO of Absci. Absci is a 4-year-old biotech company currently located at the Otrati Bioscience Incubator in Portland. My co-founder and I started Absci in 2011 with the goal of lowering the manufacturing costs of therapeutic proteins and antibodies. These proteins and antibodies are used to create top-of-the-line cancer treatments as well as treatments for other diseases. By 2013, we had outgrown our first lab space at the Portland State Business Accelerator and had increased to 4 full-time employees. In 2013, we moved to the Otrati Bioscience Incubator and leased one of the biggest labs in the incubator at approximately 425 square feet, along with office space for the team. This year, we are continuing to support 4 full-time employees, 4 four to five local consultants and plan to add an additional three to five full-time employees by the end of 2015. Uhtrati has been vital in supporting our rapid growth in Oregon. As you know, lab space is extremely hard to come by in Portland and the rest of the state. I had very few options on where I could go due to specific safety regulations and functionality aspects that go into a bioscience lab. The Uhtrati Bioscience Incubator has been more than just a space to us. It has helped stimulate collaborations with other tenant companies. ABSci has been able to partner with Aeronora, another company housed at the OBI, to improve their manufacturing process for a drug that they are planning on taking through clinical trials in the next year. We enjoy sharing the space with like-minded companies and can often share resources and ideas by working together at the OBI. Uhtrati also has a lab housed in the same building as the OBI that includes expensive but necessary equipment that tenant companies can use, as well as the staff to help if needed. Being able to share this equipment has saved ABSci valuable capital in the early stages, allowing for us to fund more full-time employees. Uhtrati also awarded ABSci with a $35,000 grant that was instrumental in helping us generate the data that was necessary for securing our first revenue-generating customer. Currently, ABSci is working on other large-scale projects and planning to hire an additional three to five employees by the end of the year. Given that, and the growth that we have, the additional 425 square feet that we have is just not big enough for our growth. And currently, all the labs at the OBI are leased out. That's when Dr. Jennifer Fox and the team at Uhtrati stepped up to help us and secured a loan from the governor to help build out additional lab space. That build out is going to be giving us an additional 225 square feet, as well as allowing other companies to join the incubator. As ABSci continues to grow, we expect that Uhtrati will play a huge role in our success and allow us to commercialize this highly needed technology, along with foster innovation and bioscience growth here within the state of Oregon. That being said, it is critical that organizations like Uhtrati continue to have your attention and your support. ABSci has high growth potentials beyond 2015, and we expect by the end of 2015, we will be seeking additional lab space again. Right now, I don't know where we can go that will allow ABSci to grow within the state of Oregon. We continue to work with Dr. Fox and Uhtrati on creative solutions, but your continued investment is critical to our success and success of others in Uhtrati. So I'd just like to say thank you, and thank you for your support, and I can answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much, Mr. McLean. Any questions? Thank you very much. You're giving us a good sense of organizing, particularly as a panel. We appreciate it very much. We're going to move on to the Oregon Growth Board, which is sort of the next stage in the general evolution of companies in terms of access to capital. And we have the chair, Jerry Langler. We have four others, so I'm just going to read them in order. There are three chairs here, and then we'll call up the remaining person. So Eric Rosenfeld from the Oregon Angel Fund, Paula Moretto, hopefully I've got that right, from Nuovola, and Brad Hunter from Craft 3. Actually, we'll do two, I guess, Brad, if you can hang on a minute, we'll call you up. Right there. Perfect. And then Matt Ellis, you'll be on deck as well. Please, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Reed and representatives. I'm Jerry Langler. I'm co-chair of the Oregon Growth Board. In my day job, I'm a general partner with OVP Venture Partners, a venture capital firm. But before I go into the slide, I actually want to go back in time way before this. It's actually almost exactly 34 years ago today. I was sitting in a conference room with a couple of guys, and we were going to co-found. We were co-founding a company. We were sitting there with a venture capitalist from California, and he said to us that he really liked what we were proposing to do, and was interested in funding us if we would move to Silicon Valley. And we swallowed hard and said no. And so that's the reason that Mentor Graphics is here today.
Thank you.
We started as a company. Mentor Graphics is now over $1 billion in sales, over 1,000 high-wage jobs in Oregon. But I can assure you that we had to think long and hard about that decision, and there are many other startups who probably have been asked the same question who didn't come to the same answer because they didn't have that option. And part of what the Oregon Growth Board is about is to make sure that those questions don't get asked, that the venture capitalists who come to look at Oregon startups are interested in funding them on their merits and funding them here and allowing them to stay and grow here. And I know part of one of Business Oregon's real thrusts at this point is far better to grow our own than to try to get in the zero-sum game of fighting for new plants or new companies with other states. And all the things that go with that. So that's
the backdrop. For 1 second, most microphones you got to get really close to. This one you got to be a little bit further away. It'll distort a little bit less.
Okay.
Thank you.
So that's the reason that I feel passionately about what the Growth Board is doing. I have sort of a personal experience that could have gone the other way. So looking at the slide, the program of the Oregon Growth Board is to invest a small percentage of lottery dollars that then invest in other firms and in firms that invest in companies. So we do not invest in individual companies, and then help close the capital gaps that have been identified in Oregon for startup companies and their growth. The primary outcome is a fair financial return. So getting to the question we were asking earlier, you know, we are very focused on internal rate of return, you know, the financial number. And yes, there's secondary outcomes that are very important. But if we don't get a fair financial return, we haven't done our job properly. The secondary outcomes are, however, very important. High-wage job creation, the number of businesses that are helped throughout the state, private dollars and other dollars leveraged, so it's not just us, not just the state's dollars doing the work, and serving what have been traditionally underserved communities, which encompass a range of things in the state as identified by the capital gap studies that have been done, including across the geography of the state, women and minority-owned enterprises, and various industry clusters that have not always been high on the list of places where people want to invest. A lot going on in this slide. May be better served for you to have a hard copy to look at later, but let me just highlight it. One of the things that, having just heard from the Oregon Inc. folks, this is sort of like a food chain, and we're the next step in the food chain. So if Oregon Inc. is as successful in helping create Oregon-generated companies through the Signature Research Centers and others, those companies then need money, and you heard a little bit about people going out to raise money for that. Our job is to invest in venture capital and private equity funds that will come in and see those companies and say, oh, that's a really good business opportunity. We want to invest in you. So that, first of all, we have to get them here even to look. And then having looked, we want to invest in you and invest in you here and allow you to have the capital to grow. And so as you look at the arrows kind of in the middle there, you know, Oregon Inc.'s job is germination. Our job is development or helping those companies get developed through the funding that they get. And then farther down the line, other parts of Business Oregon then are involved in the growth stage when they're looking at things such as debt. And the real issue here is to create this funnel of business opportunities and job opportunities in the state. You start with hundreds of startups, literally hundreds of startups, very few employees each. You just heard from a couple. And they're looking for hundreds of thousands of dollars investment usually to get going. But then they get winnowed down. Not all of them are going to succeed. But what we want out of that is tens of companies, each with high tens to hundreds of employees, and they may take millions of dollars to get their next stage of growth. And finally, out of that, a few drop out the bottom of the funnel, but those are the ones that really have tremendous economic power for the state. We have a few companies with hundreds or thousands of employees, tens of millions of dollars of investment. And needless to say, by the time you get to the bottom of this funnel, those folks are generating a tremendous tax flow back to the state. The Oregon Growth Board The funds flow looks kind of like this. So lottery dollars come in the top. There's a little bit of other dollars I'll get to in a minute, but it's mostly lottery dollars coming in the top. A little under $10 million a year is what it's been. We in turn invest then into venture capital and private equity funds who in turn invest in companies. Some of those companies are successful, some are not. But on balance, if enough are successful that those folks make money, that money flows back from the companies to the funds, from the funds to us. And then we have the opportunity and obligation to deliver dividends to the Education Stability Fund. While some of the money gets recycled back into that bottom part of the process to grow the whole corpus that can have more impact for the state. Over time, this has been a very successful model. To date, and this goes all the way back to 1998, which was called the Oregon Growth Account, now called the Oregon Growth Board. I won't bore you with the details of that transition a couple years ago, but 2,000 high-wage jobs created, 120 companies backed on the average of $10 million investment in each. So a $1.2 billion leverage. This is investments by other funds that Oregon did not invest in coming into those companies. So 10x leverage, $23 million in taxes paid by those companies and their employees, and no net cost to the state. I think this is really important. I mean, this is not just a job creation engine, although it is, but the fund is in the black. So we have invested this money over time. That money has come back. Some has gone to the Education Stability Fund. Some is being recycled. The amount of money that's come in is less than the amount of money of that sum of what's still in and coming back and dividended out, and with the $23 million to the Education Stability Fund. In addition, in the legislation that created the Oregon Growth Board as a successor to the Oregon Growth Account, there are some new objectives added, which I mentioned earlier, which is to serve these underserved communities. And we are just now getting down that path. This is the first year we've had the opportunity to actually invest in a number of entities that are doing that, but have done so. The Albina Opportunities Corp, which is investing in minority-owned businesses principally, Craft 3 you'll hear from, and their activities, but particularly our investment in them, focused on the Northwest Coast area of Oregon, Women's Venture Capital Fund, focusing on women-owned startups, Cascade Angels and Seven Peaks on things east of the Cascades, and Echo Trust Forest, focusing on the forest industry, which historically has not been a major recipient of venture capital kinds of dollars. And we're not done yet. This is 1 year's effort, but we're heading down the path toward not only providing the returns that we need to provide to be substantive for the state and viable for the state, just as Oregon Inc. is, but also to broadening the reach of this activity. And so last slide, just to show you what a sort of a biennium looks like in our world. We have about $30 million in the Oregon Growth Board account. That's more than 2 times 9.5, if you remember the lottery money. That's because we do have money still in the bank and money coming back from successful investments, not all of which goes to the Education Stability Fund. Most of that goes into institutional, what we call institutional investments. These are venture capital and private equity funds being evaluated principally on their internal rate of return. And yes, we care about jobs created and companies helped and leveraging other dollars, but that has to stand on its own merits. Then we have two other small buckets. One we carved out of the Oregon Growth Board money, which was called pre-institutional, essentially to back venture capital funds that themselves may be startups. They may be young, they may be small, they don't have a track record yet, but we think they are in a good position to serve the state, but we can provide much smaller amounts of money to them and essentially to seed that opportunity to grow our own venture capital funds here as well as startup companies. And then the Oregon Growth Fund, which actually is a $1.9 million in the last biennium out of the governor's budget, that was much more specifically targeted at the underserved communities part with much lower IR demand on that money, really much more on jobs created and communities served. We may, you see the dotted line here, we may bucket those two together to give ourselves a little flexibility in the next biennium. We haven't made that decision yet, but I want at least to expose that as a thinking process that's early on. And with that, I will end my presentation and
So the only thing to add before I ask whether there are questions is that that $1.9 million you referenced here was in the last biennium. The same amount is in the governor's budget for this biennium, but obviously that is dependent on the legislature's action. So we'll see what happens there. Questions for Mr. Langland? Representative Hayden.
Chair Reed, you mentioned on a previous slide that the tax generated from this is $23 million, and then also $23 million was returned to the Education Stability Fund. Are those tied, or is that coincidental?
No, that is coincidental that they happen to be the same number.
Okay.
It would be easier if they weren't.
Yeah.
Probably will. Representative Reed?
Looks like a great job. It sounds like you're just awash in funds. Why do we need the extra $1.9 million?
The $1.9 million, because the Oregon Growth Board's job, the Oregon Growth Board fund, without the $1.9, has a firm obligation to the internal rate of return aspect because of our commitment to the Education Stability Fund. And so the $1.9 gives us the flexibility to serve these other areas where we don't have to have that be the primary criteria, at least in the short term.
Okay. Thank you.
In other words, just to make sure I'm understanding it and try it in other words, the flow from the lottery fund has the additional restriction because it has to go back to the Education Stability Fund. The other money, the $1.9 million in the case of the last biennium, has additional flexibility. Does that work for everybody?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's two asks. There's two asks.
So Representative Wisdom asks if there are two asks. No, because the funding from the lottery is standard, has been the case for quite a while. Okay. That will continue. The $1.9 million is the ask. That's right.
Right. And again, I think the issue is we did add those underserved community issues in the last biennium that we were able to do with the $1.9, and we think that's important for the state. We think that broadens the reach of the whole opportunity here, and so we would not like to see that go away.
Very important for my district.
Very good. Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your presentation, too. With the pre-institutional $2 million that you have there, what's the difference between that and the Oregon Inc.'s investment? What's the difference between those two?
Thank you. Our investment, again, Oregon Inc. is not investing in funds that would then invest in startups. They are investing in the activities that they do, the companies and so on. We are not investing in any companies directly. By statute or not, but it's certainly by behavior. We invest in third parties who will actually help fund those things that Oregon Inc. helps start. And the pre-institutional side is just for smaller, younger, less proven private equity groups that we think have promise but would not meet the full criteria of the left-hand bucket, where we actually, a very, very rigorous historical, have you made money for me before, or me or somebody else before.
To break it down even further, maybe Oregon Inc. invests in technologies as opposed to funds. That makes sense. You had a follow-up?
Yeah, if I could.
Please.
So does the Oregon Inc. investment money, then does that help them chase some of that, the left-hand bucket? Or
As the Oregon Inc. investment money, you can think of as seed corn, right? They're helping create the seed corn that then, these folks come along with, with fertilizer and water and a bunch of other things.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Who's next? Eric,
I'm happy to go next.
Great, thanks.
Chair Reed and members of the committee, thank you for having us. I am Eric Rosenfeld, the founder of the Oregon Angel Fund, and we are a very collaborative venture fund comprised of Oregonians investing in Oregonians. We're Oregonians love to shop local, we like to eat local, and thanks to the Oregon Growth Board, we can now invest local, and we make that happen. We started in 2007, and in 2008, the Oregon Growth Account, the predecessor of the Oregon Growth Board, made a $1 million investment in the Oregon Angel Fund. And since then, the Oregon Growth Board has been investing $1.5 million per year in the fund. And each year we do a new fund. This year's fund is $8 million. So the state of Oregon is a little under 20% of our investor base. And our investors come from all over Oregon, from Southern Oregon, the coast, the gorge, Central Oregon, the valley. And our investments span across the state as well. We have two investments in Corvallis, one in Eugene, one in Bend, and the rest are in the greater Portland area. We've invested in 40 startups in Oregon over the last 8 years. And those startups have grown to now employ over 1,900 Oregonians. And most of those companies had just a handful of employees, if any, at the time that we invested. And two-thirds of those companies had zero revenue at the point of our investment. The other third had slight revenue, less than $1 million. And we are often the first, we're often the first formal investor in these startups. Some of them do receive funding, grant funding from Oregon Inc. To help commercialize their innovation. And our role is often to get these companies to market and see if there is a market and a replicable business model, and if we can help them scale and become substantial employers in Oregon. Our investments total now $28 million that we've invested directly from the fund. Our investors, as individuals, have put an additional $16 million in the same portfolio, and those dollars have leveraged over $200 million of investment from other VCs and angel groups from around the country, mostly from the West Coast. And there's about 20 venture funds now that have invested with us and after us in these Oregon startups. The state now receives about a 3-to-1 return just on corporate tax and payroll tax revenue from the portfolio. So for every dollar that the state is investing in the Oregon Angel Fund, the state is now receiving over $3 annually in tax revenue from that portfolio. The state's also receiving a rate of return. We are rate of return driven, part of the left bucket on Jerry's slide. And those investors who have been with us from the beginning have received an annualized rate of return that exceeds 30%. And that puts the Oregon Angel Fund in the top 10% of venture funds nationally. And our model is now being replicated across the country in Chicago, Seattle, New York, and there's also efforts in Cairo, Egypt, and in Shanghai, modeling after the Oregon Angel Fund here. We would not be able to do any of this if it wasn't for the state's participation. Originally, the Oregon Growth Account, and now the Oregon Growth Board has made this possible, and here's why. One, it gives us significantly more resources to invest so we can make a material difference in these companies and help reduce the finance risk for these companies. Because we can bring $100,000 or $1 million or more and bring in other venture dollars, our typical round size is about $2 million right now. That helps carry these startups to a point where they can get to revenue so they don't run out of money before they actually prove that they have a business. So the state's involvement gives us more meaningful resources to work with. It reduces the risk, and I think has contributed substantially to our success. Also, we enjoy the support, the investment support from Meyer Memorial Trust, the Oregon Community Foundation, and other institutional investors, and they have turned to the state and the state's diligence on us and the tracking and reporting that the state is doing. That helps give other institutional investors confidence that we do everything that a venture fund does in terms of our diligence and our tracking and reporting and our financial controls. So the state's involvement has enabled others to invest in the fund as well, and they turn to the state for leadership in that area. It's been a great success, and we are extremely appreciative of the work that Tobias Reed and Jerry and others have done to make this possible. And we hope it will continue. It's a great success story for Oregon, and we're very proud of the results. And you walk around the state in Portland, Eugene, Corvallis, Bend, and elsewhere, and you see these companies thriving. And many of them would not have had a chance if it was not for the state's investment in the Oregon Growth Board.
Thanks. I gotta say, there's a distinct lack of reaction when you talked about 30% return in this audience.
Yeah, may I make a comment?
Please.
Mr. Chair. The organization kind of said astonishingly good returns. I mean, as someone who's been in this business on the venture capital side for now 23 years, I would love his numbers as my numbers for that extended period of time, and particularly when thinking about the process the Oregon Angel Fund has to go through, which I think you might lovingly call herding cats, to get everyone to agree. And Eric and his team have done an absolutely marvelous job in providing the returns, which they are the Oregon Growth Board's top performing investment. And so, we've invested in venture funds, outside the state, up and down the West Coast and some other places. It's wonderful to have the top performing fund be an Oregon native fund. And in fact, if you remember that pre-institutional bucket, this again predates me, so it's not pride of authorship. Oregon Angel Fund would have started in what we would now call our pre-institutional bucket, and they now are in the institutional bucket because they both have the longevity and the performance to warrant that.
Great. Representative McEwen.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Reed. Mr. Rosenfeld, thank you for being here. This is just an amazing success story, and we're delighted with your good works. I would be remiss if I didn't take notice of the fact that your successes are fairly metrocentric, with your exception of Bend. How could we possibly draw in the more rural areas of the state to be a part of the success that you are showing?
Yeah, it's an excellent question, and there's a couple of ways. One is ourselves, our investors are around the state, so we have investors in all the regions, and they are our eyes and ears in those areas and help us source deals. And if we do invest, they can help be our lead on those deals in their hometown. And that's a model that we continue to do. So we spend time in Baker, the Dalles, Medford, Ashland, et cetera, looking and meeting with
local. I should say Coos Bay, too.
That's okay. You get a pass. It's fine.
Everywhere. And we make sure that we touch base with people in those communities every single year. And sometimes it's just a matter of helping some of the startups get connected to people that can be helpful if it's not us. And the other thing I think it's worth noting is the Cascade Angels Fund in Bend has been modeled after us and is focusing more on rural areas. And we've been doing everything we can to support local angel groups in Medford and in Baker, in the Gorge, Corvallis, Eugene as well. But the reality is, the majority of the startups that are seeking venture capital and the majority of startups that really need the specialized resources, the talent and the technology, the specialized suppliers, a lot of those are clustered in the greater Portland area. Mm-hmm. And so we do see a concentration here in Portland.
I have to throw in a little humor. I know Seven Peaks and Ben Venture. One of them turned down the lady that the Shark Tank invested in for her pet food in Opine. So, Mr. Kuhl, I think you put $100,000 into her plan.
You've got to go wherever you can find your support, can't you? Any other questions? Representative Hayden, please.
Terry, thank you. I had a question on the return, and I think that is excellent, but my question is, does that, and I assume that it is, does that count all the employees' W-2 taxes, the 1,900 employees? Are you looking at that, or are you looking at corporate only?
For the
state
taxes,
return.
For the
yeah.
taxes that
yeah.
are being paid,
yeah.
we're looking primarily at payroll tax and corporate income tax.
For those employees,
for the employees in Oregon.
So to get to the 30% return,
it's separate from that. So the 30% return is just the rate of return on the investment itself.
Okay.
So it's dollars in and dollars back, and so that's separate than payroll taxes.
Okay.
So it's just a financial rate of return, and then on the tax, we ask all the companies to report to us annually. And there's about $5 million in payroll taxes and corporate income taxes that are annually being paid to the state from the employees and the companies in the portfolio. But that's on top of
that's
the
additional
rate of return.
That
addition.
Was my question.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's excellent. Yeah.
Representative Rudin?
Probably a strange question, but
you know, as a new, say I was starting a new company, I'd really like to be able to retain ownership of that company. Does this funding allow perhaps greater retention of that ownership over time, or is, are we still giving up our company to the investors?
Yeah, in the venture model that we follow, ownership is really shared among the founders, new and future management, and investors like us. So no one entity often controls the company, but we're all participants in the equity, and we're all motivated to work together. If an individual wants to retain 100% ownership, it's probably not the best model for us, but other sources of financing. What we want to do is grow substantial businesses that are bigger than any one individual or family, businesses that can perpetuate. And so that's kind of our model, is just to grow something substantial. And sometimes that means giving up some ownership for investors. And we usually end up with 10 to 30% ownership. For the fund and the other investors, the founders might end up with 30 or 40%,
okay,
and then management the rest. Does that answer your question?
That's very good. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Moretto?
Thank you for having me. I'm Paola Moretto. I'm CEO and co-founder of Nuvola. So Nuvola offers performance testing and analytics for cloud applications. So we tackle one of the largest problems in cloud computing today, and we are at the intercept of the cloud, software performance, and big data. So to understand what we do, let's think of a bridge. Would you let 100,000 cars go over a bridge without first testing for stress or structural problems?
If it's the
solid
bridge, yes.
Probably.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
So we probably shouldn't answer that. We'll ask the chair of the transportation committee.
So probably not, in general. But so why do we do that with software? So today's applications are tested with just 5 or 10 developers, that are not tested with real-world scenarios, like 100,000 or 1 million of users. And businesses need to find out whether their application can respond well to that level of traffic before they launch, because once everybody sees the problem, it will be too late. So with our product, developers can have a very easy way to stress test, get results, analytics, and even recommendations at a push of a button. So the opportunity is huge. We are tackling the $200 billion cloud services business and the $12 billion software testing businesses with the aim to go global. We have, in our projections, getting to north of 500 employees and a global business in 5 to 6 years from now. So we started in 2012. Literally two people in a garage. We were part of a fantastic accelerator in Bend, Oregon, called Founders Pad, that really increased our profile in terms of the business model. We found an office at the Portland State Business Accelerator, where we still are today. And then we won in the state of the three largest angel conferences in the state of Oregon, so Bend Venture Conference, Angel Oregon, and the Southern Oregon Angel Investor Network. And so indirectly, we got $150,000 from the Oregon Growth Board with a leverage investment of more than $950,000. So as was pointed out earlier, the early money, the angel money, is the hardest to get for a startup, especially outside of California, for an Oregon-based company. And this money, as I said, you know, at one of the conference, really, thank you, Oregon. So this has enabled us to stay here, continue to maintain the center of gravity of the company here, and developed our technology, build the team, and prove the market. And now we have already, one of our customers is one of the Fortune 500 in the state, and we have customers overseas, and we have growth for 2015 to triple or quadruple our revenues today. And it's not just been the capital, so it's been the ability to gain that credibility, to be able to raise additional capital, to raise our profile, to leverage the network and connections that we made in connections to those investments, and to really refine our business model to prove the market. So that's pretty much the story.
That's a good
open
story.
It up to for some questions.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Moretto? Yeah, go get them, says Representative. We agree. Thank you very much for being here. We appreciate hearing your stories. It's very helpful as we get our sense of the innovation ecosystem. So Brad Hunter and Matt Ellis are here to finish out this component. I don't know if you've decided who wants to go first, but we're eager to hear from either of you.
All right, great. I'll go first. So Brad Hunter, I'm a senior lender with Craft 3. Craft 3 is a nonprofit community development financial institution. We basically operate as a non-bank source of financing, business, nonprofit, and consumer financing in Oregon and Washington. We're a 21-year-old organization. Based, our headquarters is actually in Owako, so it's actually in Washington, but have offices in Astoria, Portland, where I'm based out of, and also we opened a new office in Bend, Oregon. So what we do, in a nutshell, is provide financing, again, to businesses, nonprofits, and individuals that can't access traditional financing. With the change in bank regulations over the last 4 to 5 years, small businesses especially have had a much harder time accessing fairly priced credit. So we are a debt shop. We provide, again, loans. We're not a VC firm. But because we're a nonprofit and also because we're not regulated, we can take a slightly higher risk than traditional banks will. So that allows us to finance startups, companies that either have, because of the economic downturn, had certain issues in their business model that they've now corrected and are ready for growth. So we've invested over the last 21 years about $300 million in businesses and nonprofits in Oregon and Washington. So a significant amount of capital has moved into, again, a space that's underserved, that has historically been underserved, and we think in the future will continue to lack a source of financing. We're not a bank, so we don't take deposits. So it's critical that we have partnerships with foundations, the state, and also the federal government that provides us basically capital for lending. And while that's important, I think that the bigger part for us is how we manage that. I mean, at the end of the day, we're risk managers. We're taking other people's money, again, in the form of grants from the Oregon Growth Board. It was actually an investment. I take that back. It was an investment that we were able to – that we will leverage about four times by bringing in other sources of money. So that's a critical component about how we do business. We take folks' money that are concerned about investment in underserved communities. So this is rural communities, communities of color, and also veterans and other underserved, especially rural communities that, again, don't have this access to traditional financing. Just a couple examples of how we work, just to give you a sense of the types of financing we provide. Over the last about 12 months, we financed a startup clothing manufacturing business in Portland. So this is a minority-owned, created five jobs, with about $50,000 from us and about $35,000 from them. So sort of classic startup. They had equity. They had a great idea. Obviously couldn't access traditional bank financing. We step in both with capital but also so with expertise. So we work with them. We're not a consultant. We don't do business planning, but we do work with them to ensure to manage our risk, but also to make sure they're successful. Another example is a $25,000 loan we did to an installer, commercial window installer in Milton Freewater. So another rural area, a guy that had been down on his luck because of the changes in the economy, obviously, but was seeing opportunities for growth. So we were able to work with him when his bank wasn't. And then to take it to the sort of other scale that we work on is a recent investment we made in Fry Foods, which is large onion manufacturing in Ontario, and that was a $10 million loan that we did to them. That's going to allow them to restart an old facility, hire about 400 people, and have a huge impact on that area. So that just gives you an idea of sort of the scale we work in. And obviously, again, partnerships with folks like the Oregon Growth Board are vital for us to continue to grow and to continue to provide these services to folks in Oregon. So,
thank you very much.
Yeah.
Any questions? Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair. Could you be a little more explicit? You said they provide you with grants, and then you said they provide you with investments. What is the flow of money coming in, and how does it flow back if it does?
Yeah. So just to clarify that, there's the total investment was $300,000. 230 of that is a loan to us. So I don't know the exact terms on that, but usually how we set that up is sort of as a 5-year payback. So that capital comes in from the Oregon Growth Board. We lever that with other funds, lend that out on sort of 3, 5, 10-year terms. As that money flows back to us in the form of principal payments, it's then paid back to the Oregon Growth Board with a return. And then there was about $70,000 of a grant that is going to allow us to do outreach, specifically in in northwestern Oregon, looking at traded sector jobs.
So then when the money gets there, is the grant money, the $70,000, treated differently? Is that for site development?
Yeah,
versus loaning to a specific company?
Exactly. So the 230 is lending capital that goes into our pool of lending capital. The 70,000 helps, again, with business outreach. We're a nonprofit, so we don't, by definition, make a profit. So we're about 70% earned income based on our interest spread. And so that $70,000 helps our operations, helps really get at those businesses, again, that aren't getting served by traditional
with
banks.
No intent. That's a grant, so that doesn't get paid back. Right?
That's true, yes.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Gangas.
Thank you. I had a question. Did you have in making these awards, do you have a formula to achieve sort of the you talked about diversity. I mean, you're talking about minority businesses or women or rural communities. How do you spread that around?
Yes. So we work in terms of how we look at the end of the year, our return, if you will. I mean, we think about financial return. We think about our loss rate, which all banks care about. But then we also have about 30 metrics that get attached to each of our loans. So those metrics are minority and women-owned businesses. So we track those numbers, and we actually, as individual lenders, that's part of our performance. So it really comes down to when we're targeting businesses, that's one of the first things we look at is, do they fit that criteria? Are they in a census track, a underserved census track? And that really sort of focuses our money. So we're not a transactional organization. We're really a results-oriented. And so we put more time and effort to those types of businesses that meet those metrics.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Ellis, back to technology.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me here today. My name is Matt Ellis. I'm the CEO and founder of Cloudability. Cloudability is based in Portland. We have 41 employees. Our job is to help large companies spend their money on the cloud better. We help these very large companies like General Electric and Nike build out cloud technology quicker and more surely and at a better unit cost than without our product. We have customers in over 100 countries, over 20,000 individuals use our software. And we've been here for 3 years, so we formed in 2011. We are only in Oregon because of the work of OAF and PSF. As you can tell, I'm not from around here, and this is my fifth VC-funded startup as an executive. I spent 7 years living in the Bay. I lived in New York and Kansas City and Texas. We could have gone anywhere. We wanted to stay here, personally, me and my two co-founders. We were only able to do that for three reasons. One is there's an inspiration by being around a lot of other companies, whether they're successful now or not. The ones that have made it are an inspiration, and you think, well, we can do that too. This is a good place to do it. The second is availability of funds. There is a great network here in Portland, and a lot of it is centered around Eric at OAF and Angela and her colleagues at PSF. You meet these people at events held at places like the PBSU, and they are literally a catalyst for introducing you to other investors. We have 3 VC investors. We have 37 angel investors. Only 3 of those are in the Bay. The rest are from the Northwest. They write checks between $10,000 and $100,000. Even the people who've never met Eric or Angela will write a check because these guys are in the round. The way that these startup businesses start, it's a huge risk. I personally bankrolled the business myself for the first 9 months, and you're looking for a very small amount of money. A few $100,000 to prove that your idea is real. This is a very early idea. You have no product. You have no customers. To give you some idea, we raised $12 million of venture capital money with 3 customers and revenues at about $85,000 a year. So to get to that point, you just need a few $100,000 and you get $25,000 checks for a dozen people. You hire a couple of friends and you get the barest minimum product out there to demonstrate the point. This has to be done quickly. It has to be done on the ground. It's done through social proof, and these organizations act as a kind of framework for that social proof. Greatly accelerated the time we could do that. And to give you an example, we incorporated the business in April. I had been writing code for about a year before, but part-time. And in November, we launched a product with about $1 million raised. And in the following May, we raised another $8.7 million that was then backed up with $3 more million from the bank. So we're talking about 13 months from zero to $12 million plus. And the result is we've been doubling our employees each year. Our average salary is $93,000. We will probably end at 85 employees at the end of this year, and probably with a capital base in excess of $25 million. The third reason why you can do it here is because there's credibility. Part of that is given by the success of existing companies, but part of it is the posture of the state government. The government can't put a lot of money in, but it can put a consistent policy where it is consistently backing up the fact that these businesses are important. And let's be clear here, we're creating new technology, but we're taking advantages of changes of other technology. So it's a race. There's a gap that's opened up. We're trying to fill it as quickly as possible. We've got to get there quickly. And anytime someone questions, are you in the right place? I remember hiring people into Kansas City, and half the people go, Kansas City? And they imagine like a field with a cow in it. But it's got some of the greatest startups in the country there. But getting over that initial hurdle is really hard. And when you have organizations from PSF who have greatly helped us, we would have taken investment from OAF if we could have made the timing work. We did take investment from PSF. And in fact, they fill a gap where a value-based fund stepped out at the last minute. They allowed us to close our round. They allowed us to get straight on the running the business. It was a critical moment. But more importantly, they represent a kind of posture that Oregon is a good place to come start a business. So to recap, you have to have a lot of small companies, you have to have credibility for the region, and you have to have access to funding, but you only need a little bit of money to get those big dollars in from the rest of the country. Thank
you. I appreciate the story.
Thank you. Mr. Ellis, thank you, and glad you're here, and hope you can create more jobs and grow jobs and grow wages. Does the Oregon corporate tax rate and tax system, is that not a factor in you buying these companies or helping these companies?
It was a headwind. In our first year, our number one expense was salaries. Our number two were taxes, and partly to the federal government, but partly to the state government. If we could have found a way to have eliminated that, we would have had another employee in that first year. It was worth it because of the other factors I mentioned. And we could have gone to any number of places. We could have gone to Vancouver and Washington and done it there. But they didn't have credibility. It didn't have a critical mass of other of other companies. And we would never have met OAF or PSF if we'd been hanging out in downtown Vancouver on a Friday night instead of in Portland.
How about Bend?
Or Bend. And it's interesting watching Bend and Eugene and Portland kind of join up. there's much more contact than there was when I came here 5 years ago.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Very helpful to get the full range of experiences. We're going to turn now to, I'll let them describe it, Jim Coonan from RAIN, Stan Baker, and Kimmy Gustafson and Paul King. We have three here, so we could do one of two things. One of you can wait, or we could pull up the fourth chair. Your decision.
Stan's going to take my seat.
Okay. Mr. Coonan.
Good morning. I'm Jim Coonan. I'm the executive director for RAIN, which is the Regional Accelerator and Innovation Network. In my previous role, I was the Venture Catalyst Manager. I worked for Economic Development for Central Oregon. I ran the Ben Venture Conference for a number of years. I helped to create Founders Pad, our regional accelerator. Helped to create Cascade Angels, our year-round angel fund. Help was instrumental in the creation of Seven Peaks, seed venture fund based out of Bend. Was also instrumental in recruitment of Craft 3 to open an office in Bend. Also created the stable of experts. Actually, my predecessor did, but we grew it to over 100 mentors to provide resources for our early stage companies. Previous role, I ran Oeco Corporation, electronics company based out of Portland. But really, for the last 15 years, I've been very focused on supporting entrepreneurship throughout the state. I was past chair of the Oregon Entrepreneurs Network, was instrumental in the creation of the Oregon Angel Fund, Portland Seed Fund, and in a previous lifetime, I was lead staff for the Joint Boards Working Group, which led to the creation of Signature Research Centers, Oregon Inc., and the university's ability to hold stocks in companies that they spin out. So, got a long-term background in entrepreneurship. Today, I'm representing RAIN, and RAIN is really an entity that came out of Regional Solutions. The original founders of that were the two mayors of Corvallis and Eugene, along with the VPs of research for Oregon State University of Oregon. Really a unique collaboration, regionally focused, with the idea of how can we take advantage of the innovation economy, with the bottom line being how do we create more successful startups and how do we keep those startups in our region creating jobs and wealth. That's really what RAIN is about. We originally got $3.75 million through Regional Solutions. 2.5 of that was for capital, 1.25 for operating funds. We're requesting another $2 million in operating funds going into the next biennium. Progress to date, we've launched two accelerators, one in Corvallis and Eugene. We've had three classes come out of it. We're pretty new. We just incorporated last May. We just got our 501c3 status in November, so we haven't been around very long. But I think we're starting to get some real traction. As I say, we've got one accelerator in Corvallis, and that's in partnership with Oregon State University. One in Eugene, which is in partnership with University of Oregon and the Eugene Chamber and the City of Eugene. Between the two accelerators, 20 companies have already graduated, and they represent a huge variety of companies, everything from BT Biotech, which is an in-field blood testing technology, to Bosky Optics, which is eyewear products using natural renewable products, Dune Sciences, antimicrobial fabric treatment. And also, one of the companies we had was actually Onboard Dynamics. And one of the expressions I use is it takes a community to raise an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. Actually, I was the person that introduced the researcher at the time to Rita Hansen, who's the CEO to Onboard Dynamics. And then Onboard Dynamics went through our accelerator in Corvallis, got that training. And then I also reintroduced them to another resource that we have that a lot of people aren't even aware of, and that's the Advanced Automotive Center through the Linton Community College. And they have an interesting test bed there. It's a little off my testimony, but they have the ability to do testing for alternative vehicles. In fact, it's one of three platforms in the Western Hemisphere. Onboard Dynamics had heard of them, but they weren't really that well connected. So a lot of what we're trying to do is really connect people to resources. In addition to the capital and the training when they go through the accelerators, just trying to connect them. And there's lots of great ideas that are outside of Portland Metro, but they often fail because of their isolation. What we're trying to do is connect those entrepreneurs to the resources that they need. In terms of our metrics, again, we're pretty early. But as I said, we've had 20 graduates. Those have generated 18 full-time positions, $5 million of revenue, attracted $1 million of investment. They've involved 700 students, and that's another key part of this. We're using students from both Oregon State and University of Oregon, either through internships or classes. They're getting exposed to experiential learning, getting them out of the traditional classroom, getting them involved in the companies. And in fact, Paul King, I think, will talk about one of those students actually joined his company, and we hope to see a lot more of that. So a lot of students, and we've also created new pools of capital. It's an interesting discussion with Eric earlier about where capital comes from. If you went 5 years ago, there really wasn't that much capital even in Portland, and you heard stories of companies going elsewhere because people tend to follow where the gold is. What we're trying to do is create resident pools of capital. We did it in Central Oregon. One of the reasons Central Oregon is doing so well right now is because we have that resident capital. That also adds an element of stickiness. People, if they invest in companies, they tend to want to keep those companies around. So we'd like to do the same. We've already created $750,000 of new capital in our region. Also, the legislature gave us a challenge of a one-to-one match. So all dollars given to us, you asked us to go out and raise an equal amount. I'm happy to say that we've achieved three-quarters of that target to date, and I expect that we will go well beyond our one-to-one match. We have also been identified as the priority for regional solutions. We represent the counties of Lynn, Benton, Lane, and Lincoln. So that's close on my testimony. I'll have the more interesting people talk in a second, some of the entrepreneurs that have gone through our accelerator, but happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thanks. Any early questions for Mr. Coonan? You do have a question, Representative Wood, or should we wait? Okay, let's wait for the other panels. We'll see.
Okay.
Thank you.
So I'll turn it over to Paul King as our first entrepreneur.
Thank you, Jim. My name is Paul King. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for having me here. My name is Paul King. I'm the co-founder and executive director of a company called KW Associates. KW Associates was developed or formed in July of 2014 in order to commercialize the technology that came out of the Department of Energy National Lab down in Albany. Hope you all are aware that there's a national lab in Albany, and it's a great resource that having spent 27 years there, I think is a bit overlooked in Oregon. I left the national lab in March in part to commercialize this. And so if you think about how me going from a position that is very, very comfortable and very, very stable to a position that is terrifyingly not. You really need, I really recognize the need to have, a foundation to help me start a company that we hope will be successful and sustainable. The technology that we are working with is basically, it's the magnetic resonance imaging for high-temperature industrial processes. So like an MRI where you have a magnetic source and a detector that spins around and you gain some information about whatever they're detecting, we developed a technology while I was at the lab that used the self-magnetic magnetic fields generated within the system in order to do the same thing. The technology we're applying to is the specialty metals industry, so think of Huacheng and Ormet. In particular, technologies that were developed here in Oregon in the 40s, 50s, and 60s at the lab that I came from, and that have remained relatively unchanged for more than 40 years. So our technology is the first time that you can qualitatively and quantitatively say something about the efficiency of the operations. So being a retreaded scientist, I like to think about, you know, how we realize this in terms of things like energy savings. And I did a calculation that said that if we're able to deploy our technology to 50% of the processes in the United States alone, we would be able to save more electricity than the state of California generates by solar in a given year, every year. So it's relatively substantial in terms of what the technology can do. So here I am, just a dumb old scientist coming out of the lab, looking for a foundation, and I discovered the accelerator. And what did that do for us? Well, first of all, it saved us, you know, in the first couple of months, it saved us more than a year in figuring out how to actually move this technology from a concept, from something that we had developed in the lab, to a product. Well more than a year in the first couple of months, and probably a couple of years. So the risk that I took leaving the lab was mitigated that way. Since that time, so partly part of that process was engaging with, like Jim said, the university and the interns that the universities have. And the interns are fabulous. I mean, the program I don't think would be as successful without the stable of interns that they have. And in fact, the intern that we have is fantastic, and you know, like Jim says, I've offered her a job, and hopefully she'll stay in the Albany area where our company is. And so she's going to graduate in June, and so she's thinking that. But in the interim, I actually gave her a piece of the company because she was so good. The other thing that the accelerator helped us to do is to recognize organizations like Oregon Best, where I have been notified of some funding that they're going to provide as an investment into our company. We are currently in negotiations for that funding, and that is sort of going to help us cross this gap, this sort of so-called valley of death that we used to talk about when I was at the lab, in order to move the technology forward. In my opinion, so I'm going to wind this up, in my opinion, organizations like RAIN and the signature research facilities are absolutely important to somebody like me who is trying to start from the ground up and trying to start, you know, the manufacturing, the supply chain, and the software engineering, everything like that. Not to mention the nuts and bolts of a company, you know, the insurance and the lawyers and, you know, all that kind of stuff that has to come together in order to make a company. We have 4 employees today. We are expecting to have another 5 this year based upon sales, and yet we still have to develop our manufacturing line, and that's sort of where all of this support that the state is providing us is really key. I think that's what I'd like to say.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair Reed and committee, for having me here. My name is Kimmy Gustafson. I'm one of the founders of Manage My Co-op. We support cooperative marketplace. So a cooperative marketplace created to bring unprecedented access of wholesale producers to a group of consumers. But let me back up for a minute. I became a stay-at-home mom when my son was just 6 months old, and it was a huge family budget cut for us. One day I was chatting with a bunch of fellow moms about how we could save our families money and still feed them good food. And we came across the fact that we could buy wholesale from local producers and distributors, but we had to meet minimum ordering requirements. We set out to do research on the best way to organize ourselves to do this. And we found that there are hundreds of groups across Oregon and thousands of groups across the United States that were doing exactly this, to pool their money to buy goods at wholesale prices. The problem is that they're doing this in really unsophisticated ways. They're using email, they're using Google Docs, they're using pen and paper. And each group has to reach out and build relationships with vendors and distributors individually. There had to be a better solution, and amazingly, there wasn't. So there are over 70 readily identifiable buying clubs in Oregon and many more at the grassroots level. However, there are over 900 farmers, ranchers, dairies, fishermen, and industry suppliers. Connecting these two groups has to be tackled in a formal way. We're already doing this with 3 buying clubs here in Oregon and have watched how cumbersome developing and managing these relationships with the vendors and farmers and wholesalers can be. This is a market wanting to buy local at wholesale rates, but finding the farmer, developing the relationship, knowing the inventory, and ordering is not easy. Local food wholesale distributors that we've interviewed have noted that an average of 5% of their business consists of these grassroots buying clubs for organically grown company. That's just over $7 million a year. And for Hummingbird Wholesale in Eugene, it's $350,000. That's a number that I might add has grown 600% in the last 5 years. With Manage My Co-op, not only do we give these groups the support to run their orders, we give them access to a curated list of vendors and their catalogs who work with buying clubs, all in one easy online platform. So that's what we do. But our company is only a year and a half old, and we couldn't be where we are without the support of organizations like RAIN and our local entrepreneurship incubator, Fruity Lab. We completed the RAIN Accelerator this past fall in Eugene. There we were connected to mentors who helped guide our business, and we were provided with classes on topics that we needed to address for better, more sustainable growth. There are mentors that we are still connected to, and we talk to on a regular basis. We just met with one last week, actually, who is helping to put together our marketing and sales plan. Also, RAIN has connected us with MBA researchers at the U of O who are helping us to identify, quantify, and predict this new market that we're tackling. And through RAIN, we've also been connected to Oregon Best. We're currently in the final stages of our proposal for their commercialization funding. And if this funding goes through, we'll be able to support 4 paid staff members and launch us forward. With the help of RAIN, we're now poised to grow a software company in Eugene where we would have otherwise not been able to. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to take your questions.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Let's hear from our last panelist, and then we'll ask questions for the whole group. You got one right in front of
There's
you.
One right in front
There's one right in front of you. Oh, the keyboard, not the microphone. Okay, sorry.
Could I switch places?
Yes, sir.
Representative Reed, Chair, and members of this committee, I'm Stan Baker, CEO of Baker Seed Technologies, and along with my wife and co-founder, Glenda Baker, owner. Thank you for this opportunity. If anyone here has ever tried to plant grass seed or plant their lawn, you've probably done what I've done, gone down to the local lawn and garden store and bought some grass seed, and on the back you see that most of the seed, maybe all of it, has been produced in the state of Oregon. It also says to buy fertilizer, so $20 for the grass seed, another $20 for the fertilizer. Go home and plant it, spread the fertilizer and water it, and keep it watered. If Oregon grass seed, you can always count on having a beautiful lawn. Oregon grass seed is our fifth largest crop in the state of Oregon. Some 1,500 farmers produce our grass seed on some 500,000 acres statewide. And this seed is then cleaned and conditioned in some 390 plants throughout our state. Of this, some 10,000 jobs are created primarily for rural Oregonians. The seed is shipped 98% outside of the state of Oregon. It is shipped throughout the nation and to some 60 nations around the world for the purpose of planting golf courses, land reclamation, pastures, and other purposes. Planting a golf course is a lot like planting a lawn. 10 years ago on the island of Cyprus in the Mediterranean, I planted a golf course with grass seed grown in the state of Oregon. And in the state of Oregon, I coated it with a lime and a superabsorbent polymer for the purpose of retaining water. I paid almost as much for the fertilizer I bought locally as I did to bring the grass seed from Oregon to the island of Cyprus, planted the grass seed, planted the fertilizer, and as I was managing the grow-in, I got to thinking, what if I could figure out how to put the fertilizer around the grass seed? When you apply fertilizer, a certain portion of it leaches into our groundwaters and creates nitrates, which are health hazards. Other portions of it, such as the phosphates, leach into our waters and create algae growth and dead zones. Some of it is emitted in the air as nitrous oxide, which is a greenhouse gas 300 times as damaging as CO2. I didn't get the idea in my mind. I did bring the course in, 120 degrees Fahrenheit in the day, hot, dry winds every afternoon, but I brought it in on time and under budget. When I got back home, the idea stuck with me, and after several years of intensive research, I saw how it could be done, and so I did it. On the left is my wife, Glenda, and co-founder, holding some of the results. On her left is the seed coated with my polymer technology with fertilizer. On the right is the standard coated grass seed that you can go down and buy in a store today. The application is consumers want
the same thing a golf course owner wants. They want a beautiful green lawn, least possible cost and least amount of effort. Our solution of including fertilizer in the coat of grass seed provides a beautiful green lawn at half the cost in half the time. I'm about as much an Oregonian as you're ever going to find. My family's lived here since the 1840s when they came across the Oregon Trail. I was born in Dallas, Oregon. Spent many times over here in Salem growing up. My bachelor's is from Portland State University, my master's from George Fox University in Newburgh, and my doctorate in 2013 in crop science from Oregon State University. I am not an employee of Oregon State University, although I am a courtesy graduate faculty appointee and making money moving forward with Baker Seed Technologies. About a year ago, I realized that there is a dramatic change coming in the grass seed industry. In 2014, $500 million, 20% of which was coated grass seed, 80% of which was uncoated grass seed. By industry and academic projections, by the year 2019, we are expecting $800 million in lawn seeds, with 20% uncoated and a complete switch to 80% uncoated. I saw this coming wave, and I wanted to catch the wave. There's going to be some dramatic changes going on in Oregon's grass seed industry and in the seed industry worldwide. And so Baker Seed Technologies was formed thanks to Oregon Rain and the OSU Accelerator. I found out about the Accelerator last March, and we joined the OSU Accelerator in 2014 in May. And since then, my existing formulation is now an NDA protected trade secret technology. We're in the process of filing patents, and it is a platform technology that also applies to grain and crop seeds. I'm now starting to work on other major crops from the state of Oregon. Oregon Rain and OSU Accelerator was a tremendous help. Without them, we would not be in existence today. There are three main reasons that Oregon Rain has been a tremendous help to us. Number one, we went to the program and we learned how to do a business canvas, which is a business plan. What needs to happen when all the way from the beginning to the end of founding a company. They helped me in putting together a five-year financial model with sales and costs all the way down to the performas, the financial statements, the P&Ls, and the balance sheets. Of greatest importance were the advisors and mentors that became available to me. With these advisors, Ron Emerson, Don Whitaker, Ken Rick, Mark Lieberman, and John Turner, those two are co-directors of the program at OSU, and Rob Schneider, I could lift up my phone when I needed help and give them a call. I could send them an email or a text, and they always answered. At the beginning, I needed lots of advice. I really did not know the path forward, and these world-class business talent, they gave of their time freely to help me and to give me the advice that I needed. The result is that I developed a go-to-market strategy. We have our first customer, $250,000 in sales. We'll be actually mixing the grass seed this week, coating it the week after next, and shipping in March. We have targeted the top retail chain stores throughout America and are working with regional formulations and developing our Baker brand. Our current milestone timeline is this year to continue growing our consumer retail market share, continue our research and development on the next generation grasses formulation, and by 2019 to have other coating formulations for other seed products. We are Baker Seed Technologies, providing beautiful lawns in half the time at half the cost. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Baker. I really appreciate the range of products and companies and problems you're all tackling. We have just a few minutes for questions if anyone has them. Representative Hayden.
Chairman, thank you. Mr. Baker, Belshaw Wagon Train, 1953, so you got me by a little bit. Does the coating process play into or eliminate any of the possible tension with GMOs getting what some of the GMO people want to accomplish through coating rather than through actually changing the seed?
An excellent question. And the answer is yes. The seed coating technology, basically what it is the first step is to apply a sticker or polyvinyl alcohol in order to second glue. Then
Lime dust is applied generally at 200 mesh or 69 microns or smaller in size. And throughout the lime dust as it's applied, superabsorbent polymer, which is a water-absorbing polymer, is applied at that point in time. And then different nutrients, but also chemicals, fungicides, and other organic fungicides, chemicals can be applied in the coating process. It can be GMO or non-GMO seed. It makes no difference. An advantage in this process is there are organic products that can deal with issues of damping off, which is when the root, of course, is damaged by fungus that are in the ground, can provide the proper amount of nutrition. This ties in precision agriculture, and that you have different large fields that have different nutritional requirements for it. So as a result, in giving the plant the ability to grow and develop into a plant can be in part done by the seed coating process. Currently, there's much work being done by a number of companies on this very same issue. Are there ways of putting the exact amount that's required around the seed so you do not have materials leaching into the soil or emitting into the air so that you can enhance the current gene of the current seed?
Thank you.
It's not the full answer. I don't want to say
I was trying to get at, could you accomplish what a GMO is trying to accomplish through coating or partially there on a non-GMO seed?
GMO is, as a seed develops into plant, there's the early issues that happen, and there's the ongoing issues as far as disease and pests that can attack it. There are GMOs out there now to where it's not only just that they are resistant to herbicides, like in the soybeans or the corn and so forth, but there is some resistance now when it comes into certain pests and diseases that are GMO function. Hypothetically, there are materials that could be placed in the seed coating around the seed that could enhance the ability of the plant to protect itself against some of the damages that the GMO is meant to protect. In doing so, you do increase the yields if it's a grain crop, because a healthier plant is going to produce higher yields.
Thank you.
Other questions? I really appreciate you all being here. I wish we had a lot more time, because I have a bunch of questions about the things that you're doing. It sounds terrific, and I hope you'll come back. Unfortunately, we're right at the end of our time, and a bunch of us have to scatter to our various caucus meetings to get prepared for the floor. But please don't take our quick departure as any indication of our interest or happiness with what you're doing. We really appreciate you being here, and look forward to seeing you again. I'm going to close the informational hearing and ask if anything else to come before the committee. If not, we will see you all on Wednesday morning for continued discussion. Thank you. We're adjourned.
Yeah. Very interesting.